Good evening and welcome to Conversations with Crystal. I'm your hostess, Crystal. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. This evening's artist is a country music mountain man, and he's had a career as a musician and class entertainer for 20 plus years. He's had great success with the release of his debut EP, Mountain Man, with 5 high charting positions out of 5 releases. How fantastic is that? Please welcome Jed Zarb. Good evening, Jed. How are you going today?
Yeah, great, Crystal. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thank you. I'm getting there, I think.
Well, is it raining down your way?
Oh, look, it was. We had a really torrential storm earlier. So thank goodness that's passed because the puppies don't like it.
Oh, no. Dog likes lightning and thunder. I'm lucky I'm up in the Blue Mountains and it wasn't too bad.
Oh, that's a blessing then.
I think you all got it down on the flat.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. I was really excited to be able to connect with you, Jed, and to do this interview because I saw you around 5 years ago. You played at my dad's 80th birthday party.
How small is the world, man?
Yeah, and I was very impressed then. You were doing like a one-man solo show, and what got me about you was the tone of your guitar, how you play, the tone of your voice and your projection and connection with the audience. I thought it was very professional and very, very nice.
Oh, thank you. That's such a nice thing to hear. I think up until about 5 years ago, I think I'd probably done close to 3,000 solo gigs.
3,000?
Yeah, I was working. I went solo. I came out of bands in 2000 after they put poker machines in pubs. I was in some pretty good bands in the 80s and 90s, like, you know, good bands that were working like 4 nights, 5 nights a week.
Wow.
And then they put poker machines in the pubs in 99, and a lot of the band stuff dried up pretty quickly heading into the Sydney Olympics. And then it was at that point where there wasn't enough band work for me as a sax player, rhythm guitaring, backing vocalist to keep going and making a living. So I went into a sort of a duo situation in 2000, and that ended abruptly with a tragedy. The girl that was singing with me, her partner, died suddenly in a work accident. So that kind of left me solo in 2001.
Wow.
And I never stopped. That was it. I either had to just bite the bullet and go solo, or just give up the work and start again, or get a real job or something. And I wasn't kind of prepared to do that because I was, you know, fully entrenched in the music industry by then and making a, you know, a fair living. So
yeah,
I went, right, now I'm solo, I guess. So I had to learn, you know, to sing full shows, because up until that point in time, I was the guy in the band that did all the backing vocals. I was that guy in the band or the duo that would, you know, sing half a dozen songs if the, you know, the lead singer had a sore throat or, you know, but, you know, and play all the rhythm guitar and all the sax solos, because my first instrument is alto saxophone. So
awesome.
That was me as a band guy. So then solo, I sort of, over a very quick period of time, 2001, sort of 2002, developed a pretty sort of unique show that included, you know, my saxophone and some backing tracks, but a lot of acoustic stuff too. I came from musical theatre as a teenager, so
awesome.
I was always an entertainer. I was always a, you know, face the crowd, speak to them,
yes,
you know, get that sort of stuff going. So all of that combined, my solo career went really well, really quick, and I ended up playing 6 nights a week on average for about 17 years.
Wow, what an achievement.
I know, right? I think I was lucky. I think it was a time, Crystal, because, you know, when we started solo in, 2001, 2002, mm-hmm. we all of us guys who were solo, there wasn't that many of us.
No, there wasn't.
Because there was no such thing as performing arts schools or, high schools that did, high-end music. So anybody who did music who could stand there, play a guitar, sing and entertain a crowd had the benefit of a musical family or a extracurricular music.
Absolutely, you're right, yes.
And nothing else, a musical theatre like I did. So, the solo duo scene kind of didn't explode with, huge amounts of artists until, the high schools started putting on performing arts high schools. And then, of course, we've got a lot of really talented young people coming out. And I suppose some of those guys are in their 30s now because they kind of started, started sort of pumping those out in the mid-2000s.
So
I was in a sort of a place where there was a lot of demand and a lot of demand for solo entertainers because band rooms had disappeared, mm-hmm. but not enough solo entertainers to go around. So I ended up with residencies, in some great hotels. Like I was doing Mondays at the Bourbon and Beefsteak for a long time and Tuesday at the Coogee Bay Hotel for many, many years and mm-hmm. Wednesdays at the Orient at the Rocks for many years and Thursdays between King's Cross, O'Malley's Mansions. Penrith Panthers put me on a Thursday residency for many years. And then Friday, Saturday, Sundays, weddings, parties.
Anything. weddings, parties, anything, yeah.
So I never looked back. Once all that started, I just got into this routine of, kids and it was only kids and music. That was it. There was nothing. There was nothing in between. And some vocal rest every school holidays. I'd take a couple of weeks off, hang with the kids, and try not to say much and rest the voice.
Try not to yell at them. In my case, in any case. Well, that is such a great career. I never knew that there was so much to you. So I'm really happy that I found this out and that we're sharing it with everybody else as well. That's quite an achievement. Now, I thought of a few questions as you were talking there.
Sure.
So one would be when you decided to go solo, well, actually I've got a lot of questions. When you decided to go solo, how hard was it for you having only been a backing singer? Yes, playing rhythm guitar, but only doing backing in certain places, so you would have got used to that, to then trying to learn you were already learning you already knew the guitar part, but learning to sing over that at the same time in a lead vocal place.
So I was lucky enough to be able to sort of play and sing because I'd kind of always done that in my bedroom and growing up, I had five brothers and we all played guitar and things. So, mum was a piano player and dad was a trumpet player and we'd have these sort of jams so I could play enough guitar and sing songs. And I mean, as a teenager, I loved John Denver. My first songbook was a John Denver songbook and it had all the chords and words in it.
Fabulous. Excellent.
I learned the best of John Denver out of one book, and that's pretty much as far as it went as far as my repertoire. I didn't have much of a repertoire when I went solo, but I did have the ability to play and sing at the same time. So the biggest thing was just the pressure you feel being there on your own and delivering every song. And, to go from backing vocals where – that's an art on its own. So if you're going to sing harmonies, the art is that you mimic the tone and the phrasing of the lead singer that you're doing harmonies on.
Yes.
And that can change, like, from singer to singer. So, at some point you're singing on a male vocalist who sounds like Tom Jones and you've got to try and sound like him or at least match some tone and phrasing to keep the harmonies really tight. And then I did a couple of years stint in a Tina Turner, the Australian Tina Turner show as a sax player.
Oh, cool.
Guitarist, backing vocalist, you know, bongo drum player. And I had to sing all the BVs for the pseudo Tina.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So that was a whole other thing, you know, her phrasing, her tone, her, you know. So I was a chameleon. I didn't really have my own voice. So when I went solo, it took me sort of probably a couple of years to find out what my own real voice was.
Yeah.
Rather than pick a cover and you know, a song and mimic it. But I thought, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to be genuine about it and I'm going to have, you know, a longevity in this, you really have to find your own voice and nurture it. So I was able to do that too. But in short answer to your question, I went out solo. I did it badly until I got better at it. And I think in some respects that's a lesson in life, is nothing comes easy. You don't wake up one morning being able to sing.
No.
And play and entertain. And, you know, I had some wins and some losses in the first sort of 6 to 12 months. Did a lot of work, a lot of practice, and came up trumps. And then, you know, within that 12 months, I kind of got returns. I was starting to get returns on every gig I did. And then.
Excellent.
Demand grew. But I just went out there.
Well, it takes a lot of guts to do it. You know, it takes guts to be in a band, takes guts to do a duo, but it takes even more to be solo because, as you said, you're there on your own.
That's it.
And everything falls on you.
And there's no vibe on stage. Like, I even remember just in the duo sense, let alone the bands, you know, if you're feeling a bit flat, you turn up and everybody's vibing each other up. And, you know, if you're having a bad day on the music and your sort of chops are a bit down, then you've got other people around to sort of pick up the slack for you and you,
yes,
you know, and but, you know, you've had a fight with your girlfriend or your wife, you turned up to the gig, you're feeling flat, that's all right. You're not by the end of it because you've got your band around you and everybody's, you know,
100%. Vibing. Mm.
You go out there solo, there's no one on stage with you. There's no vibe to be had. You know, there's no energy to come from anywhere else. You've got to produce it all on your own.
Yeah. That's certainly an art to doing that, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of psychology involved in being able to be game ready no matter what your emotions are before you run on.
You know,
I suppose it would be the same for a sportsman or anybody else, or even anybody, you know, a school teacher even, or anybody who has to give a presentation,
yes.
You know, to be able to park your emotions and, you know, be in the moment with every song and every lyric and every story that you're trying to tell.
That's it.
The distractions, for sure.
Now, how hard was it in the beginning, probably not now so much for you, but in the beginning, getting three sets of music that you could do that you thought was suitable for not just the time or the age of people that you were playing to or the venue that you were playing to? Because for me, like if you go to the country to do a country gig, without a doubt, people want some country music. But in Western Sydney, they want rock and roll, you know, like Cold Chisel and things like that. So it's a bit of a game there trying to work out what to put into your set lists and what not. So very early on for you, when you only had limited repertoire as such, how hard did you find it?
36 songs to be exact, because I didn't have time to sort of go, okay, well, I'm going to be a – it didn't happen like I was going to, I'll decide I'll be a solo act and then give myself 6 months and learn 100 songs and, you know, to put in the work and rehearse and do all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
I had gigs booked from the duo got really popular really quickly. She was a great singer. Our harmonies were fantastic. Our banter was fantastic. And we went really well, and we got really well established in that 2 years, 99, 2000. And then when she had to suddenly leave the duo, she just couldn't sing anymore, the poor thing. You know, her partner died suddenly in a work accident, and it just floored her. It was just so horrible for her. And I had the choice to either cancel
the gigs that you had
that are coming up within weeks and start again, or bite the bullet. You know, you bite off more than you can chew and then chew like crazy.
I certainly do.
So that's what I did.
Well, you succeeded. You succeeded very, very well.
But in answer to your question, I tried to get three sets of 45 minutes, was 36 songs.
Mm-hmm.
I had about a dozen at that stage. I think within 2 weeks I had to, you know, my first solo gig was coming from that point. I think we blew out the first couple of gigs before I could sort of work out what I was going to do and whether she was going to come back and sort of like, and when she wasn't coming back, I think I had about 2 weeks to get 36 songs up. And that's right, I was in places where, you know, they wanted Cold Chisel or they wanted this or they wanted that. And I've just got nothing except for the 36 songs. It's like walking into Macca's, that's the menu.
Oh,
you
know? Yeah, exactly, you know, that's it.
Take it or leave it. But, yeah. You know, I think it was probably another 12 months it took me to develop sort of a variety of songs that was sort of tied me.
Yeah, into, so you could pick and choose a little bit.
Oh God! But it was frightening. It was really frightening, and it was very arduous. And then, you know, at that point in time, my wife said to me, "You'll never make it solo, mate. I'm leaving."
Oh no! So
she left me with three kids. She didn't take the kids. She met a younger bloke at work, and left me with three kids. So
from that point on,
right at the start of my solo career, I was a single parent as well. And I was a single parent then for another 17 years for that whole solo career. So
well, I think you've done extremely well with your career and raising your children as well in that situation, having all that turmoil. And you know what? A lot of people would have given up, and you've just did it. You just
I didn't have a choice, Crystal. Yeah, and you know, and the choice became even less when I had to deal with raising kids on my own, because if you think about, you know, what kids need, they need you before school.
Mm-hmm.
They need you after school.
Yep.
But they don't need you while they're sleeping.
No.
Yeah. So the solo entertaining thing and working at nights was more suitable, even though the sleep was hard because I'd get 4 hours after a gig and maybe 2 to 3 hours during the day.
Yeah.
While the kids were at school. But I was always up with the kids. We'd always, you know, have ironed uniforms, packed lunches, brushed hair, off to school, get all the washing into the washing machine, sleep for a couple of hours, get up, hang it out, pick the kids up from school, get them something to eat, get them bath changed and into there. And then when they were little, it was like the babysitter had come in at about 6-7 o'clock or, you know, whatever time gig I had to get out the door to get to the next gig. And
yeah,
as they got older, you know, as my eldest son turned 15, it's kind of happy to leave them at home on their own for at least a couple of nights.
Oh, yeah, yeah, won't hurt them.
Well, they were pretty. They had to kind of grow up a little bit quick. So, at 15, my oldest son was kind of quite, you know, mature, and so with my daughter at 13, you know, they were. And then we had the little boy, little Johnny. But I mean, we got through that as a family, and the kids, you know, came to gigs with me on, you know, the Sunday beer garden gigs. I'd have my youngest at my feet with headphones on, covering his ears, and a colour in book at, you know, sitting at my feet. In, you know, at my microphone stand, and and two others running around a beer garden looking for lizards, you know.
But you know what? How cool is that? That is absolutely so cool for your children, because they're going to work with Dad. They're seeing what he's doing. He's entertaining. They're seeing that people love you, and you're giving them a couple of things: a sense of pride, but also you're giving and instilling in them work ethic and that and the music. You're giving them the music as well. So I'm very interested to hear, do any of your children play instruments and sing?
Well, my oldest son is a heavy metal guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite good at that. He's lightning fast, and he's got, you know, the big orange amp, all the equipment that the metalheads use. And, you know, he's right into that genre. And he had a really good band going here in Sydney before he, I think the band's still alive. It's just they all stopped to have babies because they're all kind of in their late 20s, early 30s, and they all got married. And they're all raising kids at the moment. But I think they still sort of throw ideas backwards and forwards and write, and they've all got little recording studios at home. And I think at some stage he'll go back into music. But he's a he's almost got his pilot's license, and he's a prison guard, and he's loving life. You know, he's
that's fantastic, fantastic.
You know? Yep. Daughter's a talented bass player and can sing, but doesn't do it. Doesn't she's same thing. She's just happy to be a mum and raise kids and go to work every day. And
yeah.
My youngest son, John, he could play drums. He started drums and he was doing okay at it. But then he got into the DJ stuff, and then after a while he got married and had a kid, and he's working in the mines now. So
Wow. They've
all got music in them.
Yes.
My six grandchildren now have all got music in them.
Excellent. Love to hear that.
I'm seeing that. But it's only me that's still going, really. It'll probably be the grandchildren that take up the mantle, I think.
Probably. Well, it's good to hear that, you know, you gave your children that, your grandchildren are able to experience that with you. And, you know, I think that's really, really fantastic and a nice family fit. Now, earlier you mentioned that you've got, what was it, six or eight brothers?
I've got five brothers, so there's six
brothers. There's six of you.
Six boys in the family, yeah, and they're all musicians.
Excellent. So where do you fit in there? What number are you?
I'm the middle child. I'm number.
So am I.
I'm number three, mate. Number three. So, yeah, so.
We've got to do things to stand out being the middle child.
Well, you know, at least you learn to sing harmonies because you're never going to get the lead role.
You know,
don't sing my line. It's okay. Well, I'll find another line. It's like, well, you know, you're the third kid, so you're going to end up singing the fifth harmony you're never going to get to sing the lead when we're all jamming. So that was pretty good to sort of end up, you know, being able to sing harmonies naturally because, you know, I had all the brothers and mum and nan around us singing, so.
That's fantastic. I love that. I love that your family is quite close-knit like that as well. You know, that you can. Now, do you guys still get together like that?
Oh, look, we're spread out all over the world and we've all got our lives and, you know, but everything's still revolved. Mum's 83 now.
Oh, God, love
her. And everything sort of revolves around mum. So, if it's mum's birthday, then, yeah, you know, or if it's that. But, you know, I got everybody's been living. I've got one brother in England and I've got another brother that's just come back from the States, you know, in the last couple of years and living up the North Coast. And then I've got another brother that's a farmer in the bush and up out towards Gloucester and I got another brother that lives locally and he's running around doing solo stuff, so I get to see him every now and again.
Excellent.
So, you know, it's not too bad, but, you know, I mean, mum's birthday, Christmas, you know, and it'd be nice to, you know, but we're all sort of different. My eldest brother, Joe, he's a world music, singer-songwriter, and he's a flamenco guitarist and all the Eastern European stuff and the South American stuff, and so he and I would probably never find a somewhere to even play together, you know. But I've done his sound before, which is good. Matt's into teaching, and John doesn't play professionally anymore, but he played a lot on my record, and you know, he's in my band. If I put my band back together and he's available, he's my mandolin player.
Oh, excellent.
John, he's the farmer, and as I said, Anthony's running around doing the solo thing, and Paul's in England. He does cruises as a piano man.
Oh, so, wow, good on him. Yeah, excellent. So for you, did you ever want to do anything else than play music? Because you had it from such a young age, well, from birth, was it ever in your mind to do anything else but be a musician?
No, it's all I ever wanted to be. But when it came to the crunch, because I wanted to be an actor as well, because I, as a teenager, you know, I was doing all this musical theatre stuff, and I was doing really well at that. I was getting some lead roles in an amateur, you know, local musical society, and you know, all ages. It wasn't just kids. It was just a local musical society for all kinds, you know. And mm-hmm. I was doing it well as a teenager, and I loved it. I loved to sing on stage, which I was doing then, and I loved acting, and I was already playing saxophone. I'd already chosen saxophone at that point in time as my main instrument, so I was already playing at church, mm-hmm. you know, in the church band with my saxophone. And before that, I was a clarinet player as a 12-year-old in the Maltese marching band down at Greystones, because Dad was Maltese,
uh-huh.
and Dad was the trumpet player. So I was already in the, you know, I'd already been playing music and acting and singing and doing all this stuff. And so when it came to the crunch, it was really hard for me when I said, okay, well, I'm going for a career in music. And Mum and Dad said, no, you're not. You're going to get a real job, something to fall back on.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm like, what? Here I am, 16, shaming at the bit, wanting to go. I'd written my first song, and at 16 I thought, this has to be a hit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'd written one song in my whole life, and I was sure
that's
where I was going to go. You know, that was my direction, you know.
Fabulous. I love that.
And but I didn't.
Sorry?
Well, I didn't. No, I didn't follow on from that. They really were adamant that I did that, and I was just trying to do my best at that. I was a good kid, you know. I did everything Mum and Dad wanted of me, and I didn't have it in me to sort of rebel either. I was never one of those rebellious kids. So I thought, all right, I'll make Mum and Dad happy. And I joined the Air Force at 16, got a trade as a aircraft maintenance engineer, and spent 10 years doing that from 16 to 26. And just did that, and played in my first bands in the 80s, you know, in 1985, 86 down in Wagga, and then 87, 88 up in Darwin. I was in a band, and then back in the 90s, early 90s down here in Sydney, I was playing in bands, and then I got out of the Air Force in 94 and moved straight to the Gold Coast, where one of my older brothers was.
Right.
And the solo duo scene thing had taken off there, and the band scene. And I ended up just, you know, playing sax for everybody, and I joined a trio and, you know, did that. Mm.
So why the sax?
Wilbur Wilde. Blame Wilbur Wilde.
Of course. Of course. So when
I just wanted to be that cool. When I was a kid.
Yeah. So when did you pick up a guitar and decide that you were going to learn that?
Well, I think I might have been about 10 or 11.
Fairly early.
Yeah, my brother got his first guitar. My eldest brother got his first guitar when he was 14, so I must have been 11 or 12. And every time I could get my hands on it, I would do it. And I had my little John Denver songbook with all the chord shapes in it. So I just taught myself to play. He was getting classical guitar lessons at that point in time. But I was given a chord chart book. So I was looking up chords and, you know, learning to play my favourite John Denver song, you know.
Oh, love it. And what is your favourite John Denver song?
Oh, there's so many of them.
Isn't there?
Yeah, look, The Eagle and the Hawk,
mm-hmm.
it's not even sung. It's just one of my – it moves me a lot. It is sung. It is sung. And Rocky Mountain High, how could you go past that?
Mm-hmm.
Matthew. There's so many poems, prayers and promises. Like, there's so many just beautiful. He's still, I hold him up as my, my guru songwriter.
Absolutely.
He's just the songwriter. I don't think I can go past him as a songwriter, you know, as a storyteller and a, you know, the poetic turn of phrase that he uses. I think very unique, and I'm inspired by him, yeah.
And do you still have that songbook?
No, I don't. Actually, it could be in one of my old Air Force trunk lockers that I've never opened since 1994, but I probably should have a look.
Yeah, that'd be great just to, you know, just for the nostalgia of it.
I can still remember, I think it was one of his albums. I think it was Country Roads. Well, did he have an album called Country Roads? Because I think I remember something like Country Roads being on the front of...
I vaguely think that, but I'm not sure.
No, me neither, because I'm just trying to recollect now, you know, yeah. 57, I'm trying to remember back to when I was 25, you know, so.
nostalgia is a good thing to visit.
Yeah, having your marbles is even better, so.
All right, so let's move forward a little bit. So now you're playing guitar, you have your solo man show, and you've also brought out an EP. How many songs have you written, Jed?
I've probably only written maybe 50 or 60 songs that I've kept. I think I've attempted writing hundreds, and I'm one of those people that if it's not perfect, in 5 minutes, I just scrunch it up and I get frustrated. I'm learning not to do that now. But, you know, from the time I was 16 to the, you know, the time I actually put this record together, I'd had a long history of just half finishing songs and really not knowing whether a song was good or not, you know, or had potential or not. You know, and not having the self-confidence to really back myself in that arena either. So it was a sort of double-edged sword. So my solo career, when I first decided to go on my solo career, I was going to put out a record then, and I actually started recording my first record in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I suddenly became a single parent,
mm-hmm.
I'd recorded a couple of songs with a mate and, you know, I thought they were crap. He thought they were great. I was never really into those songs. I didn't, you know, but I thought that was the career that I'd been waiting for. I'd been waiting for that time. I went and did my real job thing and then I got back on that horse and, you know, got established as a musician and went for it again and, you know, suddenly became a single parent and tried to do it a little bit while I was single parenting, and it was just too hard. I had to work too much.
Yeah.
Bring in the income. So it wasn't until 2018 where my youngest son, John, left home at 22.
Mm-hmm.
And I became an empty nester, and then I went, right, I'm doing it this time, and I did it.
That's it.
So I was able to release my first single in late 2018. That was when the first single, Mountain Man, came out, I think October 18. And then four releases after that.
Yeah.
And they all went really well. So yeah, it was kind of a false start sort of twice in my life for this record. And when I look at the record I produced, I'm glad I kind of didn't do anything that was really immature or underconfident, because that's who I was at those other two attempts and could have really just not done very well at all. So
yeah.
Life takes, you know, I don't have regrets and I don't have that thing where I wish, or if, you know, if this didn't happen, I could have done this, or if this didn't happen, you know, I would have done this. I just think life shapes you in that way, that when the time's right, the time's right, and that's when it's time. So,
And it was yours, maybe, what, 2017, that's about 6 years ago, 7 years ago maybe?
Yeah, 2018. Yeah. So it was kind of in that time where I started to really start writing again and putting aside the songs that had merit.
Yeah.
You know, I was an accomplished solo artist by then and had a lot more confidence in my ability to be able to produce something. I'd been sort of counselling and helping some younger artists with their, you know, with their careers and stuff like that too. And
that's fabulous. I love that.
Well, you've got to give a little back, I think, as you, you know, once you've earned your stripes in anything, I think, you know what I think it is, Crystal? Mm-hmm. I reckon we get to an age where I think, you know, as much as you start walking when you're one and you, you know, you stop your day sleeps when you kind of turn three, I think you kind of get into your late 40s and I think you just got to become a mentor. I think it's part of what you've got to kind of.
Part of the rite of passage of life, maybe.
I think it happens. I think it's just a phase that I think a lot of people go through where you want to give something, you want to give something back to somebody.
Nurture
somebody or something and impart your knowledge. I think that's just part of growing up and growing older.
Yeah.
So I sort of had that experience too. And when you've got to impart your knowledge in a way, it solidifies your own knowledge in something. It organises your own knowledge in something.
Well, that's
rather
very
than trying
true.
To draw this stuff from all corners to try and give someone advice. They're asking you questions and you're drawing from all corners, but once you've drawn all of this stuff out and put it in a row for somebody else,
yep.
They become in a row for yourself.
That's right. That's exactly right, yes.
So all of those things happened for me, and when I put my record together, it was the right time and my ducks were in a row and mm-hmm. I had the right people around me and the right opportunities came up and we'd saved enough money to do it. I did a bar job 2 years before we started the releases so that I'd have enough money to release properly and publicise the releases properly.
Because it costs quite a lot of money to do it that way, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's even more costly now in some respects because there's no TV coverage and there's no back announcing on radio now. You know, everything's YouTube and stuff. So, you know, you can put out – I actually did have a one song go to number one across Australia on the country music charts.
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
But nobody knows your name because they play the song and they don't back announce you anymore. It's something that radio DJs don't bother doing anymore, rarely.
Yeah, right. Well,
but you know, people know your song.
Yeah.
But they don't know who you are and they've never seen a picture of you. You've never appeared on telly. You know, you're anonymous.
Yeah, look, I think that's where the music world is lacking a little bit because we've lost shows like Bandstand or Sounds Unlimited or any of those kind of things because of YouTube exploding and Facebook exploding and all of that. And I certainly know a lot of people that they're still kind of looking for that. They don't necessarily like the new way. It's very sterile, I think. You know, the way things are now opposed to, you know, earlier, some years ago where, you know, everybody was kind of more connected, if that would be the correct word.
Yeah. In essence, to become a household name, there was fewer channels of media, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, you had four or five channels of media. You had the radio and the couple of TV, free-to-air TV stations. And if you appeared regularly on one of those or, you know, on a big show on a big night and got a lot of coverage, then you could become a household name.
Yeah.
But now it's not that – there's just so many avenues that people can obtain, you know, their favourite stuff to listen to and their favourite programs to watch. And less and less it's free-to-air television and analog radio or even digital radio now. It's YouTube, it's Facebook, it's TikTok, and people find their little niches in those places.
That's true, yes.
And it's a matter of trying to bend and shape with the time. It's just that the monetization is not there to have what we inherently had as a career in music. So the only way that I can find, wouldn't matter if you were a great TikToker or what, and, you know, I mean, people are downloading your songs or streaming your songs. I'm still only earning 0.003 of a cent per stream on Spotify.
Yeah, that's just crazy, yeah, disgusting, so isn't it?
Well, I got a check. I got my Spotify remuneration the other day at $4.85 because I'd had 1,200 streams in the month.
1,200. Oh my god! 1,200 streams
in the month, and I got $4.85. You know what I mean? Yeah. So the only way to, you know, and I don't care who you are, you need millions and millions and millions of streams to sort of get back to equating to people buying your record or your CD, you know. Yeah. And even now, so the only way to make money and to keep the career going is to gig. Now at 57, I'm still able to sing three, four shows in a week over a weekend.
Perfect, yep.
But there's a lot involved in your fitness and your vocal technique to be able to sing night after night after night after night without getting a strain or without getting nodules and all of those kind of things. So
that's true. Not to mention lugging all your gear around.
Well, that's it. I'm still lugging a fairly hefty PA because, again, the new ones I see coming out. You know, they'll sit on a stool,
yep,
with an iPad in front of them and one plastic speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying none of these kids are talented because some of them are extremely talented. They've got these amazing voices and can play guitar like I could never hope to play.
Mm-mm.
But they're sitting there with about, a couple of thousand dollars worth of sort of low-grade equipment, sitting on a stool, staring into an iPad, not making eye contact with anybody,
yep,
and sounding like a CD, you know, in the corner and not really engaging and stuff like that. And there's so much of that. And I'm still old school. I go out with 3,000 watts like I'm a band still.
Yeah, you must be a strong fella, that's all I can say.
I'm still lugging that gear, you know what I mean? So I'm still, it's actually not bad because I don't get to the gym much anymore, but I do hurt a little bit the day after, but I'm still running out with, a good couple of subwoofers and some big sound. And it's not that you need to be that loud. Your sound is full.
Yes.
Now, 3,000 watts doesn't need to be cranking at 3,000 watts with, the treble cutting your head off.
No.
You know, you can have 300 watts filling a room, but you've got to have it cranked and it's needling and it's a harsh sound.
That's right. Okay. That's right. True. Well,
you can have 3,000 watts set up and it's idling and there's no needling. There's no needling harsh sound across the room. It just fills the room with sound nicely and people can still talk.
Yeah,
as long as you pull, what I do with my EQ is I pull the frequencies that people talk at out of the front of house, right?
Okay.
So everybody talks at about, between 4 and 2 kilohertz, and I just dip those out. And so it's funny, people have got this little window of EQ where there's not a lot of sound.
Right. Oh, that's I'm not great on the sound, on how to EQ things, but I can certainly kind of half understand what you're saying, and I think that's a great idea. Now let's talk a little bit more about your equipment. So, what brand of guitar do you use?
Well, I'm not sponsored, and I'm not a great proponent of the company because I've had. We won't say anymore, but I've got a Maitland 808 that was a friend's guitar, and I was looking for a guitar at the time because I'd just worn out my Martin and Luthery Canadian guitar. I just destroyed it. It'd done about, 600 or 700 shows, and I'd torn the face off it. Because I really strive. When it comes to playing guitar, I'm a really good sax player. Like, I'm more a percussionist, really, on an acoustic guitar than I am a polished guitarist. But you know, I'm more a percussionist, and I take the faces off guitars, and the hardest guitar I've come across is the Mate, and it's done. It's in hospital now getting a refurb.
Oh, good-o, yeah.
But it's done. It's seen half the solo shows I've ever done. It's done about 1,500 of them. You know, it looks a bit like Trigger, like Willie Nelson's guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite as bad, but it looks a bit like that. You know, all the bracing inside of it's all smashed to bits. It's all getting rebraced. I get it back. So this week I'm playing a Chinese Alvarez.
Okay, now how does that stack up to your original guitar, the Luthiers?
The Canadian Luthiers.
Yeah, one. And, you know, between the three guitars, how does that stack up to it, the newest one that you're playing currently? And how did you come about it? How did you find it?
Well, that's a really good question, Crystal, because I came about it First question. Stacks up great.
Excellent.
I've only done about a dozen gigs with it in the last couple of weeks, and it's held up very well. The jack's come out of the back. I've had to sort of put gaffer tape to hold the back jack. It's got one of those pain in the bum jacks that goes through the strap at the back rather than up under the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. But sound and build and action and tuning, fantastic. Can't fault it. Can't fault it as a playable, really good playable, tunable, resonant guitar. And it was, you know, $900.
Wow. So how did you come across it? Did you just go into a shop? Did someone tell you about it?
No, but since a lot of people have picked up. So I was in Tamworth not so long ago when we did that Tamworth Festival. So it would have been, I think, January.
January.
I knew the time was coming where my guitar would have to go to hospital. It was on its last legs then.
Oh, right.
And so I was talking to the guy at Capitol Music in Tamworth, lovely people, and I said to him, look, I'm just after another guitar, and I was actually going to buy another 808, you know, another.
Yep.
They're a BG 808, and the BG stands for bluegrass, so they're a small-bodied guitar.
Yes.
And they're a mighty sound. And I developed a sound with that Maten. I customized it, so it's got its own sound. It's a sound that I can't live without, so I need that guitar back.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed something to play because I knew the guitar would have to go away for a couple of months because Luthiers are hard to come by. The good ones are backlogged for 3 to 6 months in advance. So, I knew I'd have to leave my guitar, have a spare guitar. You know, I had a spare mate, and then the Seagull, you know, the Seagull's up in Queensland with my eldest son, the old Canadian guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to sort of get that back off him. But and my first mate had been signed by Johnny Diesel, and I didn't want to go out and destroy that and take the face off that again because I'd had it refurbished and put back together. And
Yeah.
It's in mint condition.
Beautiful. Is that an 808 as well?
No, it was just a Performer, a 1987 Performer that I stuck the AP5 pickup in, So it was never even an electrified acoustic guitar. I made it into one.
Right.
And it was a brilliant guitar. That was my first career guitar, and I pretty much destroyed that. Then had it rebuilt. When Diesel signed it, I had it rebuilt and hung it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the Canadian guitar, and it was really soft timber because the timber they made those out of, they raised the sunken logs from the bottom of the dam at Quebec.
Oh, yes, yep.
And it was 800-year-old timber apparently, and they raised it and dried it out and made these beautiful guitars out of it, which was great. It was a fantastic guitar except, I use a 1 millimetre plus thick pick.
Oh, my God. Right.
And for your listeners, it's probably like, you know, thicker than a bread tie. probably as thick as your credit card, probably a bit harder and a bit sharper.
Oh, yes.
You know, and so when you're sort of scratching across the face of guitar, even though it had the tortoise shell thing, mm-hmm. either side of the tortoise shell, because the timber was so soft, you know, I was tearing holes in the damn thing, so.
Oh, my goodness.
So I only got about 600 shows out of that, you know, three years.
Maybe. Only?
Three years, I think.
Only 600 shows, you know.
Well, it held up for 600, but don't forget the 808 that I'm playing now has done nearly almost, well, we're getting close to, we've probably done about 1,500. So,
wow.
So it's, and the face of it, you know, it's obvious it's scratched to pieces. And I think if you go on to the Jed Zarb Facebook page, if you look me up on Facebook,
I have, yeah.
And just go through the images there, you'll probably see a photo of it. It's got the Southern Cross burned into it with a soldering iron, because the guy that I bought it off was a good mate,
mm-hmm.
and he paid good money for it. And the first thing he did was burn the Southern Cross into it.
Oh.
And then he hardly played it for 12 months. And because they're a small body guitar, they're not very loud with you when you're jamming with your mates in the lounge room.
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted it for. So he said, look, it's not the guitar for me. Do you want to buy it? So I got it at a bargain at $750. It hadn't been played hardly.
Oh, my goodness.
But it had the Southern Cross in it.
Yep.
So that kind of somehow has become my trademark too. It's just, and it totally does go with me because I am patriotic and I do love my country. And I,
yes.
You know, it's not that I'd get the Southern Cross tattooed on my forearm, but that's not because I'm.
Yeah, it's just not you. Yeah,
I'm a tattoo guy, but it looks better on the guitar than on my skinny Maltese forearm anyway.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the music that you're producing of your own. And in producing, I mean writing and what you've already. You're doing music right now of your own, recording your own songs?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Perfect.
So we put the first EP out, and the way I describe that is kind of because it's you've got to be careful here because things can get quite political, especially with, you know, different genres of country. So the bluegrass crowd are very adamant about what bluegrass is and where it comes from and how you play it.
Yes.
And I agree with that. I think you want to preserve those things. Although there's a lot of bluegrass flavour in my music, I can't call it bluegrass and I wouldn't call it bluegrass. But if for your listeners, if you like, you know, fiddles and banjo mandolins and, you know, a little bit of a stompy sort of mountain feel, That's kind of where it's heading. But then it's also very inspired by John Williamson style Australian storytelling as well. So
yeah,
about mid-2000, I think 2005, 6, 7, somewhere in there, I got the opportunity to go overseas and entertain the troops.
Oh, did you? Wow.
Yeah, I actually got to do that twice, and that was because I was down, you know, Coogee Bay Hotel, and mm-hmm. I got spotted down there as somebody who'd probably be right for that gig. But I went over with John Williamson the second time, and I got to hang out with him for 5 days and travel with him. And what we did over there in the Solomon Islands, we went to entertain the troops there. There was Tongan troops and Kiwi troops and Aussie troops and Aussie AFP, and there was, you know, all these little islands we had to hop to on a helicopter, you know, to the remoter islands to go and just entertain the guys, just drop in, say good day, press the flesh,
yeah,
you know, talk about home, make them laugh, sing them a few tunes, and that's the whole idea, you know, lift the morale.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure that you did that very well. And going with John Williamson too, how cool is that?
Well, that's the thing. That was the thing, right, because as a songwriter I was more sort of John Denvery and then sort of, you know, Australian-wise, you know, Finn Brothers,
yes.
Paul Kelly sort of orientated.
Mm-hmm.
But after that experience, I knew who John Williamson was, and I knew – you know, Hey True Blue, and, you know, I saw him on the rugby singing Waltzing Matilda every rugby match and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I had no doubt of who he was, and but I'd never actually sat and watched a whole concert or listened to an whole album.
Yeah, right.
So I had to go and do supports for him for that whole 5 days, you know, get on, warm the crowd up. And then he'd get on and do his thing, and I was just blown away.
He's a great lyricist, and he's also a great guitarist too.
Oh, we sat in the hotel room one night in the barracks. Shouldn't say hotel room because we're in the barracks at Honiara,
mm-hmm.
and with Mozzie nets and no fans.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, but we loved it.
Yeah.
Griselda, and he's trying to show me how he thumb picks. So he's stuck one of his tortoiseshell thumb picks on my thumb and was trying to show me how he does that stuff. I tell you what, you've got to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time, and I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right, he's a damn good guitarist.
Yeah, look, everybody has their own unique style.
Yeah.
And, you know, so what's right for one person is not necessarily right for the other. And I'm sure your style and what I have seen of you is it's unique to you. And why would you want anybody copying that anyway?
No, you wouldn't. But I would just to answer your question,
mm-hmm.
there was a big change in the ideas at that point in time about how I wanted my music to sound. And, you know, and the songs I started writing post that point were very inspired by that style of storytelling. And another one that's the female version of that to me is Sarah Stora. So, and I had her out on a hay run. I come across her and her brother Greg. And, you know, the way that they play and sing and tell their stories is very, you know, in that good Australian ilk. So, you know, we've gone between John Denver, with a bluegrass feel,
mm-hmm.
and Australianising it all with an inspiration of John Williamson, I think you have my music.
Yeah, and I think it's very unique and it's very alluring is what I think.
Do you like it? I'm so pleased you like it. Yeah,
I do. I've listened to, well, as I said, I saw you 5 years ago at my dad's party and I thought, oh, this guy's really good. And then, you know, I have kept an eye on you over time and seen these songs come out, and so I've listened to them and over, and I think there's bits and pieces in there that where did you come up with that from? Do you know what I mean? Like it's just one of those things, and I really love what you're putting out, and I really look forward to seeing your next, what you bring out next.
Well, Crystal, I'm in the studio. As I said, I don't have that same sort of, you know, because and please don't get me wrong, anybody listening to this, because we all suffered the same thing. So the way that we were going to recoup that investment, you know, if we're thinking in business terms, you make an investment of the record.
Yeah.
And the way you recoup that is you do all the festivals and then you tour.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So in 2019, I got to play main stage at the Boy Up Brook Festival in Western Australia because of my number one.
Excellent.
I got picked up pretty quickly. I got to Music in the Mulga. I got to Groundwater Festival and the Blue Mountains Festival. And it was the Blue Mountains Festival that was the first one to cancel during COVID.
Yes.
And then every booking that I had fell over. And the tour that we had booked for 2020 – couldn't go ahead, obviously.
Mm.
And the only way that you recoup an album is to sell $50,000 worth of CDs at $20.
Wow.
You've got to be touring. You've got to be in the stages. You've got to be, you know, and then you've got to be getting paid money to turn up. And most of the Australian festivals, apart from Tamworth, you know, pay decent coin for you to turn up and play.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not an issue. So, all of that was planned and all, you know, we would have recouped. And then in the natural, you know, swing of business, you make your investment, you recoup your profit and you repeat.
That's right, yeah, rinse, repeat.
So
yep.
We never got to the rinse and repeat part because we never got to recoup because that record came and went, and even although the singles did very well, you've really got to have something in the charts to be able to get on the next round of festivals. So it's a double-edged sword. I can't. I may be playing at Gympie 2024,
mm-hmm.
But it's not like I'd be doing the Tamworth, Denny Ute, Muster, Groundwater, you know, blah, 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 boy up Brook.
Well, that's what my next question was, is what festivals are you doing next year?
Well, none unless I release a single.
So you can't even get into those unless you're releasing a single?
Well, not you know, you're down the bottom of the list. It's not impossible.
Okay. Yep,
but,
yep,
you know, but, you know, if somebody – and I kind of agree with this. If someone's got the expense and you know, to release and promote a single – and it's done really well for them,
mm.
I think they should be prioritised.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, yeah.
Spot, you know, and you know, I feel like, you know, my time came and went and I lost control of that because of COVID. You know, we couldn't tour. The festivals that I was chosen for
fell over, everything stopped.
Fell over, and then by the time we got, you know, by the time you get to 2021 and you booked them again and they've fallen over again, and then you get to 2022 and you haven't had a single on the top 10 for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And the people that could keep going and could keep releasing were the ones that, you know, had a day job or had a mum and dad with, you know, money behind them, or had good savings themselves, or had a husband or wife that, you know, could keep working through COVID and keep the business running. But, you know, I didn't – all of the money that I generated for the record was 99% generated from gigging.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And so, you know, during that time we used our savings, we used our super –
mm-hmm.
Just you know, and after it all, it's only recently that we're sort of back into sort of 3 pub gigs a week, and trying to recover and rebuild. And but as I said, the good news is I'm learning how to do it myself, and I'm really hoping that I can get my music at home to a standard where I can have a release in the near future.
Well, I'm sure you will, because the home systems now and the computers and the recording software and all of that, it is every year getting better. So I don't see that there's any reason that you can't do that, and you're doing it from the comfort of your own home as well.
You know, the thing I didn't do was curl up in a ball and suck my thumb. I learned how to use the equipment and the software whilst, COVID was on, whilst we were locked down, and whilst so – I've kind of invested in that now.
Yeah. Good.
You know, my time rather than money.
Yeah.
Into that. So I'm sort of confident that I might be able to get something up, you know, sometime in the early, well, maybe the first quarter of next year. I'm really hoping that I can do that.
Oh, so that's 2024 for the listeners, just so we can clarify 2020. That. 2024. Yeah. So you mentioned that you've gone from pre-times to maybe 5 or 6 nights a week doing your solo show to now 3 shows a week.
Because that's all Poppy can handle, Crystal.
I'm sorry? Yeah,
that's all Poppy can handle.
Lugging that PA, I'm not surprised.
No, three a week. Luckily for me, I established myself very well.
Yes.
And I've got a name. I've, you know, from playing around Sydney since, you know, solo since 2001.
Yeah.
And people haven't forgotten, and I can still command sort of good money in solo land to go and to do a show. So three enough's pretty good.
Yeah.
If I get 4s and 5s, great, you know, I'll do them. But I don't think I could consistently do them like I was doing them when I was in my 30s and 40s and early 50s. I don't know about you, mate, but it was so hard to get myself back up into fitness to go and do 3 shows in a row after not doing a gig for 9 months. I think 9 months was the longest period through COVID.
Oh, the first one I did, I just looked and I went, oh, I need a painkiller.
Yeah, well,
it was just you've got to be kidding.
I did take a painkiller.
Yeah,
and honestly, I was, you know, I was going out and giving it all guns blazing, like as if I'd as if I'd just came off six nights a week and was going back the next night, go out there as fit as a fiddle. I was going out there after not doing a gig and trying to do the same show, and really just at the end of it was absolutely stuffed. And it took me a day to recover when I first started gigging again after COVID. But now I've got it back to fitness and back to vocal health and back to, you know, back to my most. But I don't think I'd want to do more than three a week now.
No.
I think that's enough for my knees aren't great, my back's not great. And I have been lugging that PA for
20 years.
Well, 25 years.
25 years.
Yeah. I mean, we started the duo thing in 98, so then that was crossing over with the band, sort of getting slower and slower at 98, 99, and,
Do you think, are you much happier doing your solo show than a duo? You know, it's not about the people, it's about, you know, whether you've now grown that accustomed to doing your own solo show, or would you like to do in the future maybe a duo show or have a full band again, or that's just kind of not where you see yourself?
I don't think I'd do it formally, but when it comes to festivals and things, if I actually get another record out, then yes, I'll put a band together. And there's no greater joy than being in a band and having a band produce that sound and having great players around you and having that energy on stage. I don't think you can beat that.
There's something about it.
I think the days are gone. Like in the 80s and the 90s, I made a good living after I got out of the Air Force just playing in bands. I was playing sax and guitar and getting a gig with – I was playing for seven bands at once at one point.
Oh, my goodness.
And working four band gigs a week.
Yep.
You know, and five band gigs a week until 99, so that wasn't too bad. But I think the times are gone where it's easy to make a living as in a band, but it's easy for me being established to make a living as a solo artist.
So let's talk about this. Your last EP that you've brought out, it was called Mountain Man. And as I said, the Hillbilly Cider, which I really love, it got like number one in five, six different places. And you've got Stay For A While, that's all also rated. The Archibald Hotel, that was number three on country songs. Battle Scarred Guitar was number four on country songs top 40. And Mountain Man was number seven. I think that is just fabulous.
And Stay For A While went full commercial and got a top 20 at number 14 on the country on the Music Network charts. And that was because that got picked up by commercial radio, by Kix and by ABC. So that's actually probably the biggest gong is having a top 20 on the national commercial chart.
Yeah.
But the good thing about the country songs chart is that that's probably a real chart. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the best of the independent charts because it's not about who thinks you're the best. It's about, I think there's about 2,500 community radio stations Australia-wide that send their song lists in weekly, and the most played song gets the number one spot. It's not like someone thought you were good in a, you know, for instance, the Tasmanian charts, it's the DJ that thinks, I think this one should be number one this week, you know. Mm. It's not like that with the country songs charts. I think they're probably the most realistic the most realistic gauge of how well your song's been received. So to have a number one there, to me means a lot because it just means that all of the country music, independent country music radio stations and radio shows all across Australia were playing it to death. And it stayed at number one for 2 weeks. And it also debuted at number one on iTunes in Australia. So it just means that there was a lot of hype around it as well. When it came out, it was only my second release. So that kind of gave me the courage and the confidence to just keep going and keep releasing and keep playing and keep writing. And
Absolutely. And as I said, I really look forward to your next contribution to the music world. So have you got a title for the next album yet?
I don't know what I'm going to do with that because albums are kind of dead in a way. you know, people do albums now, so because the Golden Guitar Awards, you know, require you to have an album.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And some different awards and, you know, ARIA awards and different things require you to have an album. But if you're trying to reach an audience, build a following and sell CDs, which is the business model.
Yes.
For an independent like me, it's more about staying current. And a lot of people are just single after single after single. If you think back to the late 1940s,
mm-hmm.
right, somebody like Elvis or anybody would walk into a radio station, say, I've got a great song. If the DJ gave them a go,
yep.
you know, 200,000 people would hear it. Mm. Then you'd run down to the studio, you'd record that single and put it on a vinyl and give it back to the DJ and they'd play it. And then if that worked, you'd do it again and you'd repeat rinse. You didn't start with an album. You started with single after single,
yeah.
trying to do it 3 months apart so that the DJs would keep having you and be looking for the next bit of vinyl. And those guys used to work their butts off as shoe shiners and everything, just every penny they could get
yeah.
to go back and get the next little 45 vinyl.
Uh-huh.
And take that up to the radio station, you know, 3 months apart. And in a way, we're back to that.
Yes.
So what happened is, you know, when they formalised the record companies in the 50s and 60s, rather than getting there and record single at a time, they'd get an artist into the studio because it was expensive and they'd record the whole album
uh-huh.
and then they'd choose singles to release.
Yeah, right.
And we kind of worked that model right up until now, but it's flipped back on its head because of social media and YouTube and all the way that people digest music now, where you've kind of got to have a single out every 3 months. You've got to remain current and you've got to have an audience to keep shooting that at.
Right.
Right. So there's a reason I would do an album, and that could be the Mountain Man, the album, which means that, you know, the 6 songs that are on it, I might add 4 or 5 more to.
Yep.
And make it Mountain Man, the album. Or I might start from scratch and just get 6 singles in the loaded, you know, recorded, mastered, ready to go, and then do a 3 month, you know, 3 month about campaign.
Uh-huh.
And if I got up to 12 songs in that campaign, I'd stick them all on one album and call it something and release that album probably after the 12 singles had been released.
Yeah, right.
You know, so that's kind of the business model now. It's really flipped on its head very quickly.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get my head around it and keep up with it at the moment like so many others.
But, yeah, that's a lot of information you've just said, and I'm thinking, oh, that is a lot to deal with.
It's a lot to digest, but to put it simply, I'm going to keep recording the singles that I've written.
Perfect.
And I think I've got 4 on the burn now. If I can get 3 of them mastered sort of in the first quarter,
yep.
that kind of gives me 3. That gives me 9 months to sort of get the next 3 singles up and mastered and keep and continue the 3-month blitz, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
I'm not about blitz, you know.
So this, your current EP that you have out, Mountain Man, so where mm-hmm. can people purchase if they want the actual CD? Where can they purchase that from? I do believe I've got several different links for your social pages and web pages and et cetera.
Yeah, so look, there is a website. It's musopromotions.com/Jed Zarb. And if you go to just musopromotions.com and navigate that and find me, you'll find my shop.
Mm-hmm.
And you can purchase my CDs there through PayPal, credit card, whatever. But if you sort of want it to be a little bit easier, then, you know, send me a message on Messenger on Facebook, Jed Zarb. There's a page there. A music page, just send me a message and say, look, I'd like to buy your CD and I'll send you my bank account details and you can send me your address and I'll mail it out to you. Come and see me at a gig. I've always got them at my gigs. So if you want to know where I'm playing and you're like really into my music, I've got a closed group of about 400 people.
Nice.
That I speak to, that we, you know, we share, we joke, we laugh. I put pictures of my Maine Coon cat.
Oh, have you got one of those?
Yeah, got a little Maine Coon that's very popular on social media, so I throw her up every now and again. And, you know, I have my little rants there and stuff, you know. But on my friend page, what I found was, you know, my music page, I can post something about where I'm playing.
Yep.
And people who even like and follow my page might not even see it within days or even weeks or at all.
Yes.
Unless I boost it to the people who are already following me. I've got to pay money to boost it to people, and then they still may not see it. So I invite those people every now and again on my page to, look, if you're really interested and you really want to know where I'm playing week to week, join my private Facebook group, and it's called Jed's Shed.
Jed's Shed.
J-E-D-Z Shed.
I love that. Well, I'm certainly going to do that because I want to.
Join the shed, become a sheddy.
A sheddy.
And once you're a sheddy, you know, if you're at a gig, the good thing about Facebook groups is if you're at a gig, you can actually post on that page. You know, you can't post on my music page and you can't post on my friend page. Mm. But if you're in the group and you're out watching me play, you can snap a photo of you and your mates at Jed's gig and post it to the Jed Shed page and say to the rest of the shitties, look where we're at.
Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. I love that.
But there's a bit more interaction in the group with you know, the followers and the friends, you know. I all of the people in the shed I've had some sort of personal connection with at some stage, and I know them by name, and, you know, they've come along or they've contacted me and said, look, I really love your music. This is my favourite song, and let them into the group, and next thing you know, you're in their region or you're in their place. You know, I went to Queanbeyan, I've been to West Wyalong recently. You know, I'm going up to Tamworth to the Katingal Hotel this Friday. You know, I get around a bit, and otherwise I've got my regular little gigs around, you know, Bilpin and Katoomba and Penrith and places like that. Yeah. And just all the time selling CDs, getting paid to do the gig, building up the money, and, you know, that should pay for the mastering and promotion of the singles.
Yeah.
If we keep that up. So, you know, yes, you can find my songs on Spotify. And you can listen to them, and I'm grateful for that. If that's how you listen to your music and you don't have a CD player, great, you know, listen to me there. But if you buy a CD, then you're just really supporting the artist. You're supporting the next release. And even if you don't have a CD player, you're pretty much investing in the next single, and you've got a little memento of the time. If your CD just becomes the cover artwork that's on your mantelpiece or in your CD collection, it's just a memento of, you know, our meeting at a gig or you connecting with me on social media or, you know, and supporting the next release. So I do encourage people to actually buy the CD if they can afford it. They're only $20.
Yeah.
And postage if I'm mailing them to you. But if you're at the gig, great, you know.
Excellent. So I encourage everybody to see where Jed is playing at, go to his Facebook page, support the artist and support the next single and album coming out. And now one last thing, Jed. I would love to know or love to hear you recount a funny story or a story that's happened to you at a gig where you just go, oh, you go home and you go, oh, yeah, that was something. Have you got a bit of a – I'm sure you've got a few.
Oh, look, the things that really give my heart, you know, when you're playing to families, it's always the 18-month to 3-year-olds that'll come and stand in front of you and look at you like you're a rock star.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And they're enthralled with you while all the parents and that are in it, you know, and stuff. And you got these babies. So I sing some Wiggle songs and stuff, and just the reactions of these little kids to see a live artist for the first time. But funny stories, oh my God. most of them most of them I'm not rude and I'm not crude, but I'm kind of a very tame version of Kevin Bloody Wilson on stage, so there's a bit of language.
Yeah.
And most of my funny stories involve, you know, a little bit of language, but because the one that comes to mind is hilarious, but it's just a little bit naughty. Can I share it with you?
Of course you can.
All right. So recently, probably in the last 12 months, I was up at the Ilford Valley Cherry Farm. And it's this beautiful outdoor gig. You know, you're in amongst the cherry trees, you know, facing a beer garden. And, you know, people have come from far and wide to camp there. And then there's the local crowd from, you know, Ryleston and Capity and Mudgee and surrounds. Mm-hmm. And I had Pixie Jenkins, the fiddle player, with me. Now, he was John Williamson's fiddle player for all of those years that they were touring, you know, what do they call that show? Friends on the Road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about 15 years or 20 years Pixie was playing with John. And you know, he's one of our most famous Australian fiddle players, but he's also he's an openly gay man,
mm-hmm.
and he's as quick as lightning. He is pretty much in the same ilk as, you know, Rodney Roode or Kevin Bloody Wilson, all those. So he's very quick so we're standing there I introduced Pixie Jenkins and this young redheaded boy with a blush and, you know, pimply face came up and, you know, said in a broken sort of teenage voice, "Oh, my name's Jenkins too." So I said on the microphone, "Oh, look, Pixie, this young bloke's called Jenkins too. Could be your son, couldn't it?" And he goes, "Not unless there was a couple of willing dykes and a turkey baster." I wasn't able to sing for 5 minutes.
No, that was good on him. You know what I love? I love good Australian humour. You know,
That's probably the funniest thing in recent memory. That you know when you laugh so hard you just can't sing.
Yes.
Yeah, but the good thing is the crowd was laughing as long as I was laughing, so it sort of didn't put a dent in the show. But
And it would have raised the vibration up, and you know, everybody would have been really kind of high from that, you know. So,
but how fast is he? How quick?
Oh yeah,
how quick to rattle that off like it?
Good on him!
Right out of his mouth instantly, and I was just dead. That was the end of me. So,
well, I love that story, and. Yeah. Jed, I wish you all the best for the future. I'm going to attach all your links that you've sent me to the description of the show. And yep. I want everybody to look you up on Facebook and go and see a gig and support you with your music. And I hope to catch you around the traps very soon.
Well, a big shout out to your audience. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for taking the time, to hang out in conversations with me and Crystal tonight. And, Crystal, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, mate.
Thank you.
I hope we get to catch up, and I hope I get to come and see you go around. So I think I'll start stalking your Facebook page.
That'd be lovely.
I'll do it.
All right. Thank you so much, Jed. I will leave it there for tonight, and I hope to see you again in the future, as I said. Either back on here or another media. And, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, and I'll say good night.
Good night, Crystal. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. And that was the fabulous Jed Zarb chatting with me this evening. Isn't he just the wonderful Australian gentleman with absolutely fantastic music? You have been listening to Conversations with Crystal, and I am your hostess, Crystal. Until next week, when I have another fabulous guest for you, please stay safe, stay happy, stay cool, stay awesome, and most of all, please stay listening to this channel. Good night.